Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Here's an American paradox. We hate to even think about our own mortality, but we will pay money to experience mortal terror. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Haunted houses are now a $300 million annual industry, employing designers, artists, actors, and at least one sociologist. Margie Kerr has devoted her career to understanding what scares us and why we seek out an emotion wired into us by nature to kick in when we are in real danger. She teaches at the University of Pittsburgh and collects data from customers dying to be scared out of their wits at Pittsburgh's Scare House. Her new book is called Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. Margie, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We should state at the outset, you yourself are a lifelong thrill seeker. Tell us about some of the things you've done in pursuit of what is sometimes called benign masochism.
Since I was very, very little, I pretty much did anything that I thought would be really exhilarating physically. So running down hills very quickly, or one of my favorite was hanging on to the clothes racks as they spun around in circles. Not too many do that anymore, I've noticed too. But for my book, I tried to balance physical thrills with psychological thrills and get a more kind of comprehensive view of fear. So I went to Japan and South America and all over the U.S. and in Canada too, and rode roller coasters, went to haunted houses, went to haunted places, and then also tried to talk to as many experts in the field as possible. And I guess in the field, I should say that's political science, history, anthropology, sociology, psychology, really get a full picture of fear.
How much does culture influence what specifically frightens us?
So much. Our threat response is universal. So how our body responds to it is something that has evolved over time and has kept us alive. But what we're afraid of can be very culturally influenced, very much socially constructed. Now, there are characteristics that are universally terrifying, things that startle us, things that violate our prediction systems. But when it comes to what a monster looks like, or, you know, what is keeping us up at night, that's a product of time and place.
The interesting thing about thrill-seeking behavior is that it's not individuals who cannot be scared necessarily. It's people who like being scared. What is there to like about going through an experience that really frightens us?
Well, there is the natural high that people talk about, and that's largely linked to the physiological reaction. When we're afraid, our body releases the adrenaline, of course, but also endorphins and dopamine and serotonin, a lot of things that are associated with our reward circuits. So some people, and they've looked at this at the genetic level, have especially efficient systems that may be contributing to, you know, their enjoyment of it. So they may be getting an extra kind of boost from these experiences. And so that's kind of the adrenaline junkie, but it's not really the adrenaline that's sort of driving that. It's more than likely it's the endorphins and the dopamine that are driving that thrill seeking. But there's also the satisfaction that comes from challenging yourself and overcoming. Even in false or fake environments, we still do experience a sense of accomplishment. We know that the monster may be fake or that we're completely safe on a roller coaster, but our body has still been taken to that high arousal, you know, scared state, and we've made it back the other side. And, you know, evolution, time has really made it so that when that happens, we feel good about it. We feel like we really did achieve something.
It is so interesting that with our big and creative brains, we still feel legitimately scared of things like roller coasters and haunted houses, where we intellectually understand no harm will come to us, or even watching a movie happening to someone else where there's no chance that something bad will happen to us.
It is. It's amazing, and it's something that excites me so much. When I was on the CN Tower, and I had every intention not to be scared because I really had thought about it so much. And I thought, well, there's no way that I could be hurt. You know, I'll be attached to a harness. I'll be protected in 10 different ways. But it doesn't matter. All of that rational thought, all of the things that you know to be true, go out the window as soon as you look down and that lizard part of your brain says, you know what? You're not a bird. You can't fly. You're going to die. And it's just amazing. It's just amazing that we can be so intelligent and yet completely, you know, reduced to this primal kind of state in the face of fear.
I've had that same experience. I climbed a telephone pole at some, like, you know, like executives go and challenge themselves thing. And I had a helmet and a harness. And I actually thought it'll be fun if I fall off because who cares? And I got down and my mouth was so dry that I couldn't even speak.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, our body responds even when our, you know, thinking brain knows that we're fine. Hmm. Yeah.
Is it possible to experience something like PTSD from a frightening experience if we understand all along that we're safe?
Yeah. PTSD is, you know, a very serious health condition. And the, you know, those who experience it can be triggered by pretty much anything. It's very dependent on the individual and that time and place and, you know, their own, you know, profile of how they deal with stress, but it can result from a safe experience. For example, you know, if it's a thrill ride or a roller coaster or a scary movie, you know, they could be pushed beyond that point of feeling that they're safe to true terror, and it can have lasting effects.
What's the difference between the kind of heart-rattling fear that we experience from a roller coaster or a near collision on the freeway, for that matter, and the sort of persistent low-grade dread that we experience as anxiety?
Yeah, it's different physiologically. You know, our body deals with chronic strain in a different way, and that's where you see a lot of the negative health consequences, the, you know, increased levels of cortisol, things that are going to mess with our metabolism and our energy we also see, of course, you know, depression and anxiety as outcomes of chronic strain, chronic worry. And so that's the not fun fear and it's more, you know, persistent and over time rather than an acute startle or, you know, a 20-minute haunted house. That experience is going to start and end in a pretty short window and our body can return to homeostasis. But with chronic worry, it does take its toll on our body and our brain.
So as you mentioned, the first phenomenon that you write about in the book is physical thrills. And it's reasonable to say that just about everybody is a little bit afraid of heights, right? And a little bit afraid of small spaces, a little bit afraid of the dark. There is something weirdly pleasant about that sort of dizzy weakness that comes from, like, peering over a ledge several stories off the ground. Why in the world does that feel good when clearly that feeling physiologically is supposed to tell us to get away from there?
Yeah, it feels good, I would say, probably about maybe 2 minutes after the initial terror, because it's hard to – it's so hard to tolerate in those first few seconds or minute when you're looking over the edge. Even if you're inside in a glass elevator, it just – you know, it's really challenging. But once you do remember, once your executive functioning kind of reminds your lizard brain that you're safe, you can enjoy it. You can sort of – lean into it, so to speak, and just kind of feel how your body is responding. And it's very much like when we were kids and would, you know, twirl around in circles and then just fall back on the grass and watch the sky spin above our heads. There's a real enjoyment that can be found when you just sort of let your body, you know, do its thing.
Last night, I was reading a biography of George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, for a show we have next week. And among his many achievements, people probably remember that he went skydiving, right, to mark these big birthdays in his life, notably the summer of 2014 when he turned 90. I was thinking and wondering if part of the appeal for him was having spent years of his life being protected 24/7, like with somebody 18 inches away from him at all times.
That's a really good question. I would love to ask him that question because I can see definitely some meaning in that. You know, if you are constantly living in a overprotected state, you want to stretch your wings and push yourself and feel, the freedom that especially comes when jumping out of a plane. I went skydiving and I have never felt so free in my life. So that would make a lot of sense, actually.
All right, I want to ask you this as a sociologist. Aside from the differences between one culture and the next that may be influenced by lots of different things, how are our fears influenced by how freaked out the people around us are?
Oh, a lot. This has been studied by lots of researchers looking at the impact of co-attention. So when you know somebody else is paying attention or doing the same thing as you, and it has a dramatic impact. If you are in a movie theater and everybody is screaming, you're going to be more likely to scream and scream louder. Same thing with a comedy or even a drama. It's intensified. When we're together, all of our emotional experiences are intensified. The only caveat, and this is what's really interesting too, is if it's a situation where one person is trying to calm the other person down, then we can have a sort of leveling out effect. So one person, holding the hand of someone as they try to sort of talk them down. But if it's a situation where everybody is screaming and laughing, then we're going to scream and laugh more because the way that we understand what someone else is going through is by recreating it ourselves in our own body. So the same parts of the brain that are active in someone laughing or screaming are going to be active in us when we watch them do that. So it's altogether intensified. And I think that really speaks to how we have evolved as a species to essentially do better together.
It is interesting, that experience I've had it where you have two people in a room who have reason to be, or somewhere, who have reason to be equally frightened by something. And sometimes one person who's still a little bit freaked out will be the voice of reason. And I always think that's a fascinating effect.
That's what you see that in groups. You know, people do sort of take on these different roles. And the difference is context. You know, if you're all sort of choosing to engage in something like a scary movie or haunted house, then the goal is to, to scream, to have fun.
Right.
If you're in a real, tragic situation, that's where we really see sort of our role-taking behavior go into effect. And someone is going to take the role of the leader. Someone's going to take the role of the sort of person that's, freaking out. And we sort of do that to try and create, something that is going to help the situation. You do see that people tend to fall into those roles, especially in times of real threat.
Margie, does deep engagement with our own fears tend to affect the kind of empathy we feel toward other people?
I believe it does. And, the more kind of you're in touch with your own feelings, the more you're able to appreciate and understand what someone else is feeling, because, again, it's the same brain systems that are at work in those two instances. Being able to really truly feel and understand your own fear, you can use that to then understand somebody else's fear. And it may be a different fear, but at least you have that understanding of what it feels like for yourself.
We're speaking this hour with sociologist Margie Kerr, who teaches at the University of Pittsburgh. Her new book is called Scream: Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. If you'd like to ask a question or tell a story, you can get in touch with us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email us, think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
They just want to help you.
Not Daddy.
Your daddy loves you.
Daddy loves the horses. He wants me to go away.
No, he doesn't.
But he doesn't know.
He doesn't know what? Samara?
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with sociologist Margie Kerr about her new book, Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. What you just heard was a cut from the movie The Ring, where Rachel is watching a videotape of Samara being interviewed at a psychiatric hospital. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. We'll talk about creepy kids and scary movies in a minute, Margie, but one of the places that you've determined are sort of universally frightening to people are places like psychiatric hospitals and prisons, places where we have no control over whether we get out.
Yeah, these are the total institutions that Irving Goffman talks about, or talked about rather. And they're places that really strip us of our identity. And, you know, he focuses on the negative consequences for total institutions that are involuntary. So these are the psychiatric hospitals and prisons, and even boarding schools can fall under this category. And the reason that they are so scary is because, you know, you go into a total institution and you have to go through a rigid resocialization process where, you know, who you are as a person is largely taken away from you and replaced with this institutional identity. Also in these places, there are these very strict power dynamics where, you know, complete authority is expected to be followed, and you feel essentially powerless. But not just for the inmates or the people who are being kept there, but for those who work there as well. There's this power of the institution itself that exerts itself and makes you feel essentially less than human. And that is really the reason I believe people, you know, go to these places for, you know, paranormal investigations or for photo assignments. You know, we're so drawn to these places because of the fear that they really invoke in us.
You toured, I guess, an abandoned mental hospital sort of for the fun of it, but had the sense that people had really suffered there. Can you talk about that experience?
Sure. I went to the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, which is what it was named when it was first chartered back in the 1800s. It was quickly renamed as Weston State Hospital. It's in West Virginia. And the tour of the space, you know, it's been abandoned and it's been scavenged by, you know, people who were looking for, you know, old metal to trade in. But the real terror is not the ghost stories that sort of, you know, revolve around it. And the nonprofit that runs it now, they make most of their income from, you know, paranormal investigations. But, you know, what's really scary are the actual abuses that happened there. You know, soldiers were staying there during the Civil War. There were numerous cases of rape by the soldiers of the patients that were there. You know, just countless abuses between patients and between, you know, the staff and patients. And it's just, you know, that type of abuse of power is, I think, the true kind of fear.
Are there limits to the, maybe pleasure is the wrong word, or sensation that you can get, you can allow yourself in a place like this? Like, for example, I don't think most people would tour a concentration camp for the scare factor, and yet people there have also, like, really and truly suffered because of nothing they had done wrong.
That's, you know, that's what I find so interesting, too, because I think a lot about that, you know, that you can go and tour a concentration camp, or you can go to a site that is a memorial, and you're going there for the explicit reason to sort of engage with that history and come away with more knowledge, more compassion, more consideration for the horrors that people faced. And I don't understand why that same approach isn't being applied to some of the places that now are kind of becoming destinations for tourists. You know, that I feel that same approach should be at play when we tour, you know, an old insane asylum, that it's the same kind of thing, that it's not something to sort of delight in or, you know, get scared by the paranormal, but to say, wow, this is a site of tragedy. This is a site that we tour to remember because we don't want to repeat this. And that's what when I go to Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia, which is a historic site, you know, they do a really good job of making sure that visitors understand that it's not about anything, you know, paranormal or spooky. It's about understanding this history of incarceration, tying it to today's incarceration rates and understanding that history so that we don't repeat it. So I think that today we see, you know, some places are doing it really well, like Eastern State, sort of being a site of consciousness, whereas others are sort of exploiting, you know, a tragic history for financial gain.
You write poignantly about living for a number of years in a pretty crime-ridden, sometimes violent area. After you moved away, you suddenly understood what a toll those years had taken on your overall well-being. You had to sort of live on your guard. It's an interesting reminder that, you know, lots of people in the world never have the luxury of choosing fear as a form of entertainment.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's so remarkable to see how much I did change when I moved into a safer area. And when I went to Bogota in Colombia in South America, you know, there is not a lot of engagement with, you know, what I call kind of symbolic violence, so scary video games or scary movies. And everyone I talked to there said the same thing, that there's no desire to seek that out because that's something that they're already very familiar with. That's something that they face on a, you know, daily basis. And they don't let it consume them. They don't let it sort of, you know, change their daily habits, but there's not the need to sort of kind of experience it in a fun sort of way like we do here. But what's interesting too is that even when I was living in more violent neighborhoods, I still did enjoy haunted houses and scary material. So it's not as linear of a relationship as I would like. I would love to be able to say, you know, those who are in more violent places, you know, don't like scary material, but it doesn't quite hold up that way. But you do see it at a societal level. You know, the engagement in Bogota is much less than here in the States.
All right, I want to talk a little bit about your gig at this place called Scare House. I looked at the website and it looks very elaborate. This is a professional haunted house, right? And you have these little perches behind the scenes that allow you to observe people as they go through. They don't know you're there watching.
Right.
What is it like knowing what they are in for? What's about to pop out at them before they do?
I feel the same anticipation that they do, because even if I know when an animatronic will go off or when an actor is going to deliver his or her scare, I'm feeling that anticipation of the guest walking through because they don't know. And that's exciting on my end. You know, that's, you know, it's watching them, you know, experience something that they've chosen to come and do and knowing that they're going to have a good time. And just sort of delighting in that. And then also I'm just very interested to see how they will respond.
Are there sort of patterns? Can you spot people and think, oh, this guy's going to be a screamer. This woman is just going to look terrified the whole time.
Yeah, I can see, you know, before people go in, you can kind of measure what their approach is. You know, it's very much about expectations and what they want out of this. And people who are smiling and laughing before they even get into the haunted house, they're going to be screaming and laughing inside too. And the study that I did last year and that we're doing again this year really showed that also, that, you know, if you're going into this experience expecting to have fun and to be scared and laugh, then that's likely what you're going to end up doing and you're going to end up feeling better. But if you're going in, you know, petrified, and that's something that I always, if I see someone who is in line, who hasn't gone in yet, who's, you know, about to cry, I do go up and ask them, you know, are you sure you want to do this? You know, is this something that you really think you want to do? And remind them that they don't have to.
Right.
It makes me sad when I see friends, excuse me, really push others to go through, because it's all about choice. You know, you want to choose these experiences.
So I have to ask you something I've always wondered about the performers. Now, I know that they're paid to scare people out of their wits, and we've all, you know, popped out at a, you know, friend or family member to be funny. Have you met some, though, who seem to enjoy it too much, like that seem to sadistically enjoy frightening people?
Yes, and that's a big red flag during the interviews. You know, Scare House does a really good job of hiring people who want to do this to entertain, not to traumatize. And that's a big difference, I think, between Scare House and a lot of other haunted houses, is that, you know, actors that are saying, oh, I just want to just, you know, drop people to the floor and you know, see them leave crying. That is not the goal. So, you know, Scare House doesn't hire people who have that sort of intent to make people feel bad. They want to make people laugh and scream, not scream and then cry. So yes, that's something that the managers all look out for and sort of will note and say, you know, this could be somebody who we may not want. We don't want people to traumatize our guests.
If you find that you enjoy being scared in a variety of different ways, do you have to seek out bigger and more frightening and more dangerous experiences to get the same thrill over time?
No. And that's, I think, something that's often missed in a lot of the conversations about habituation and desensitization. You know, we do become habituated to something that we see all the time. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we need to make whatever it is more extreme. It just means we need to think outside the box and do something different. So instead of jumping from ever increasing heights, maybe try, you know, a different thrill ride, or, you know, going for some sort of, you know, extreme slide or something. It's more about novelty and the unexpected instead of just more extreme. And that's a message I wish would get out there more to pretty much to everyone, that you know, different doesn't always mean more extreme. It just means, you know, novel and curious, because that's what we've evolved to pay attention to, are things that are new. So I just think, okay, well, if I've done this, you know, thing and it doesn't really, you know, take me to the same place anymore, maybe I'll go out and try, you know, rollerblading instead of roller skating, or, you know, just something different, not necessarily, you know, more.
Sometimes you know that something startling is coming, but you don't quite know when. And I know that a lot of thrill rides now are designed to really maximize this moment. You know you're going to drop and kind of free fall, but you have no clue when. What is it about that anticipation that magnifies the sensation of fear and makes it actually more pleasurable if you have deliberately sought that fear?
Yeah, it is all about the anticipation. And Hitchcock wrote about this a lot, and he really said it best. He's like, it's all about watching the bomb underneath the table when two people are talking and just wondering when it's actually going to go off. It's not when it goes off. And that's the that's really where the thrill is. And we actually have, not me, but researchers have done studies looking at that moment of anticipation. And that's when dopamine is being released. So physiologically, we are getting a big, you know, payoff from that anticipation. But it does feel so intolerable when you're just waiting and you just know it's going to happen. But that's where a lot of the pleasure is actually coming in, is because, you know, it's just that the physiological response of the dopamine and just the expectation of our body getting ready for something that we know is going to be intense.
Interesting email here from Yolanda, who writes, I was a teen who loved horror movies and haunted houses. I'm wondering how age and maturity impact how much fun fear can really be.
It does impact it a lot, but it doesn't have to. And what I mean by that is that we can continue to choose to suspend our disbelief and engage even after we sort of have become cynical and, you know, we know what's going to happen. But if you make that choice, if you say, you know what, I really want to enjoy this, I really want to just kind of recapture some of my childhood imagination and just go with it, then we can make that choice and fully engage with it. Now, there are physical changes that can influence the enjoyment of some physical thrills. You know, as we age, our vestibular system does begin to sort of decline, and so things that make us off balance are not as enjoyable because it's harder for us to get our sense of balance back. I've noticed that for myself too, that, you know, that dizzy feeling is just not quite as enjoyable as it used to be. And that has, I think, a lot to do with sort of aging. But I think if we sort of do make that decision that we're going to continue to seek new adventures, then we can enjoy them.
It would seem like sensory deprivation in limited doses would be pretty relaxing, right? And there are those tanks you can go float in now and sort of shut out the world. Why is it that prolonged sensory deprivation is so terrifying to people?
Well, it has a lot to do with choice in that case, too. And what I think is so interesting, a lot of the scares and scenes that I create in the haunted house are using things that are therapeutic. So, you know, so acupressure types of instruments and sensory deprivation, you know, in one context, they're so relaxing and the other completely terrifying. And a lot of it is choice, you know, whether or not you want to be there. But at the same time, prolonged sensory deprivation, it does make our brain just go crazy because it has nothing to process. And our brain is built to process. And so when there's nothing coming in, we're going to start processing things that aren't there or making up things. You know, I think of it kind of like a mouse on a spinning wheel. You know, it's constantly running and it needs information. And that's where we start to see hallucinations and people really going legitimately insane because their brain just has nothing to process.
We can't bear to be left alone with our own thoughts.
Yes, there's that too. Yeah.
Margie Kerr is my guest. She's a sociologist who teaches at the University of Pittsburgh. Her new book is called Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. We would love for you to join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
How can you be real when you're made of wood?
You made me real. You poured words into my head. You moved my mouth. You stuck up my tongue. You jerk. Don't you get it? You made me what I am today. I hope you're satisfied. From the song of the same name.
You just heard a scene from season 3 of The Twilight Zone in which a ventriloquist dummy comes to life. My guest this hour is sociologist Margie Kerr, who teaches at the University of Pittsburgh and is author of a book called Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. Okay, Margie, what is it about talking dolls and clowns that like most people have to admit there's something off about them?
Yeah, they are all tapping into the uncanny valley, a term that started with Freud, but then was really developed by a robotist from Japan who said that basically there is this point at which something becomes so human but not yet quite human that forces our brain to start raising the red flag and saying, you know what, something about this isn't quite right. And it basically is causing a error message in our processing, in our brain. So we see a doll that looks human, and yet it's not behaving as a human should. For one thing, it's not, you know, actually a human, but it has all the characteristics that we expect a human to have, and it just is not human. So our brain is basically saying this is not something that we can trust or really understand, and so it's scary.
Do scary materials cause us to have bad dreams?
Oh, sure. You know, images from scary material can really stick with us because they are triggering that emotional response, and emotional memories, you know, stay with us. They are more sticky in our brains. So they can come back when we're dreaming. And, you know, even for myself, I've learned, you know, what kinds of scary movies or scary content I can engage with that are not going to leave me with bad dreams, and those that will. And so I'm very selective now, because, you know, I don't think anybody wants intrusive images or nightmares from their scary kind of thrilling activities.
We have an email here from Paul who says, I've always loved roller coasters and rides and other exhilarating things and have never felt afraid. At this year's Texas State Fair, I rode a ride for the first time since becoming a parent and just screamed the whole time, I have a family, God, please protect me. Is there something about becoming a parent that actually changes inside of you to make you more in tune with your fear?
Yes, there was a great study, actually a whole host of studies that have been done looking at fear of death and how that changes when you are a parent, and how people, even if they don't fear their own death, will fear the death of a loved one, and also then fear, you know, if they are dead, because of what that would mean to a loved one. So in this case, a child, and it does sort of change the whole game. You know, it's so amazing that humans are a species that will sacrifice themselves for someone else. You know, not all species do that, but we will, you know, throw ourselves in the line of fire to save someone we love. So we do, you know, change our relationship to fear when all of a sudden we have this new person who is depending on us and who, you know, we want to be there for and care about. So it is incredible that we often can care more for others than we do ourselves, even when it comes to something as serious as death.
All right. Tell us about consulting on the design of a haunted house and the different exhibits, which I gather change from time to time to keep things fresh for visitors who come back year after year.
Oh, yeah. So basically, a lot of what I do is, you know, look at science, look at what researchers are finding triggers different types of responses in humans. And I'll share that with designers and artists who will create, you know, amazing characters and sets and scenes, and build stories around it. You know, I often will come in and say, well, you know, humans really respond to the whites of the eyes. Mm-hmm. So try and make a lot of faces with very big eyes, very wide eyes. And so they'll take that information and turn it into, you know, a room full of creepy dolls. Or, you know, I'll find information on how our body responds to sound, and we do feel a sense of unease and sort of anxiety when we're in the presence of infrasound, which is a low frequency sound. And so then the designers will take that and put infrasound into different rooms. So it's a lot of working with, you know, the artists who have that eye for making it make sense. So you're not just walking into a room and, oh, here's a picture of somebody with really big eyes and a, you know, a big speaker. So, yeah, I tell them basically the science, and they make the characters and the stories.
Have you ever had to pull back from something because it worked too well?
Yes. Yeah, we in the haunted attraction, the basement, which is a interactive, immersive attraction, you have to be 18 or over. Use of electricity is really super effective, even at very low voltages. I mean, it's not anything that could hurt someone. But as soon as people feel even just the slightest bit of electricity, they just, you know, just lose it. And so it can be very convincing when you're in a dark space, and especially if you're working with things that, like, when you can actually touch the customers, the anticipation, the uncertainty is just, you don't even need to touch them with a feather, and they're freaking out. So, yeah. But at the same time, I found a lot of things that I thought would be very effective that just aren't at all, which is sad, but interesting.
Can you give us some examples for people who are planning, like, a haunted house at, you know, in the neighborhood?
Yeah, I really wanted to use the fake arm gag, which is something that researchers have used in different psychological testing. And it basically is a process of sensitizing someone to believe that a fake arm is their real arm. And then you can essentially, you know, do something to the fake arm, say in this case, you know, slam it with a hammer, and the person will feel like it really has happened to them. So it's a great sort of, you know, startle gag. And I thought for sure that we could get it to work, and it just didn't. It didn't work. And I think a lot of that was because of the environment and the context. And I think that setup really requires a quiet space, and that's just not going to happen in a haunted house. So,
how do you protect your actors in the interactive portion of things in the basement from people who kind of freak out and, you know, take a swing at the performers?
Yeah, and that does happen sometimes. And, you know, they're all trained extensively to read people's body language and also, of course, alert security. We've got a full security team. But to know when someone is doing it out of reflex, you know, if they've just been startled and their immediate reaction is to sort of flail their arms. And that actually happens in the traditional linear no-touching haunts upstairs more so than in the interactive attraction. So they know, you know, if somebody has malicious intent or if it was just an accident. And in cases, though, of malicious intent, then they're immediately, you know, taken out by security. But in the interactive haunt, there are very few issues. And I think it's because by the time they make it in, they've been through so many screening processes and they know sort of what's expected of them and the rules that, you know, they know sort of what they're in for and how to respond.
Is there an age before which no one should be scared very much at all?
I think it depends on the type of scare. You know, for kids, swinging on a swing can be really scary, but fun and safe. So I think it depends on what kind of scare. I think that for monsters, there is an age, and that's when parenting really comes into play. Since kids do develop along different paths and at different speeds, the parent really needs to know where their child is with imaginative play and with understanding the difference between, you know, reality and fiction. And if they don't understand that what they're seeing is a person pretending to be a monster, then it's probably too early for that child to be exposed to it. And so it's really, and I teach human growth and development as well, and really stress that the importance of parents checking in with their kid to see where they are in understanding the difference between reality and fiction, because you don't want them to be traumatized because they think what they're seeing is real.
Why are we so freaked out by things that are maybe gross but really are very unlikely to hurt us, things like roaches and mice?
Well, there's some of the fear of being bitten there. Mm-hmm. You know, they look scary because they've got these sharp – they appear to be sharp, you know, feet and teeth. But also, you know, critters that are associated with death, you know, we that's where our brain goes to. You know, we see a rat and we start thinking about dirty, gross things and trash and garbage and insects and basically just illness. And that disgust response is also part of our sort of evolutionary toolkit. You know, those ancestors that were able to recognize someone who was sick survived. Those who just went up and gave them a hug probably, you know, caught the infection and died. So we have that disgust response to sort of keep us from things that we think could make us sick. And bugs, rats, roaches definitely fall into that category.
So sometimes when a crime has been reported, people know that it's been in the media too much and they really need to pull back from it, and it's kind of freaking them out. Do you think that our need to engage with scary things draws us back to stuff that, you know, we've heard the story once, that's really enough to tell us everything we need, but we end up kind of ruminating on it?
Yeah, and that's our negativity bias. We've got this, and I think it was written about all the way back in Greek times, this human sort of pressure to look at the macabre, things that we know we don't want to see, but yet we are drawn to it anyway. And that's what researchers call the negativity bias, that we are looking at it because we've evolved to sort of pay more attention to things that are different and even gross and horrifying, because something is signaling that that could potentially be threatening. And that's what brings us back to these, you know, tragic stories or videos that we just don't want to watch, and we shouldn't. And I'm always encouraging people, just don't watch the videos, don't look at the images, especially of real trauma, because we don't need to see it. It's not something that is, you know, that the part of us that wants to is that old part of us that thinks it's actually seeing something that could threaten us in that moment. Mm. But, you know, sitting on our couch at home, we're not going to be immediately threatened by this. So we don't need to expose ourselves to that.
All right. We have an email here from Danny in Frisco who writes, are there exercises one can do to acclimate to one's fears? It seems no matter how many times I stand on the edge of a cliff, I still get that pucker response.
Well, I think especially with heights, that response will probably always be there. It's just how long you can tolerate it. That's what, you know, I always say about exposure therapy is a lot of it is not trying to get to the point where you are not afraid of something anymore, but to get to the point that you know that you can tolerate its presence or tolerate the experience and be okay. So you can still have the response when you're standing on the edge, but just trust that, you know, you'll be okay, and the response will likely diminish the longer you're there. So it's just making it through that initial, what I call the stomach drop, when you just feel like, oh my gosh. So you sort of ride through that and get to the point where you're okay, and should be a little easier next time.
Do you are you home for Halloween? Do you like give out candy to kids and all that?
I don't. I'm always at a haunted house. Okay. If not scare house, then yeah. It's funny. I often forget that for most people, Halloween is just one day a year. For me, it's almost every day. So I do look forward to the day that I can be home and actually hand out candy and do the more kind of residential thing.
But who knows? I mean, a big blow up spider will never be enough for you, right?
Right.
Margie Kerr is a sociologist who teaches at the University of Pittsburgh. She is also a consultant at Scare House in the city of Pittsburgh. Her new book is called Scream: Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. Margie, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you for making this time for us.
Oh, thank you. This was so much fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Natalie Kalman-Kuhn. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.